Good morning. Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. Your panel this morning is, to my right, Justice Ann Gardner. To my left, Justice Sue Walker. I'm Leanne Dofino. We have a long docket this morning. We have three cases set for oral argument on the 9 o'clock docket, and we have two cases set for oral argument on the 10:30 docket. Mr. Mosher gotten here? Mosher gotten here yet? All right, we're going to... I'm sorry? Okay, then this is what we're going to do. We'll hear the first case, Milner versus Milner. Then we'll recess briefly because I expect him to arrive during that argument. That'll give him a chance to announce to the clerk how much time he needs. Then after that brief recess, we'll come back, probably hear the next two cases, and then recess before the 10:30 docket. So those of you who are arguing later this morning, that'll give you some idea of time. The first case is taking its full time, or has requested its full time. It's 35 minutes. They may take less, but and then we don't know about the second case. And then the third case has also asked for its full time, 35 minutes. But again, sometimes they give us some time back, so don't count on that if you wander off. All right, so is everybody ready? Okay. Megan. All right, that's Milner v. Milner.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Rebecca Tillery, and I represent Vicki Milner, the appellant and the petitioner at the trial court level. This is an appeal from a final decree of divorce, no children, that was purportedly based on the party's mediated settlement agreement. For clarity's sake, I'm going to refer to the mediated settlement agreement as the MSA. And I would also like to call the parties and the individuals involved by their first names, not because I have any intention of being informal, but simply because we have two Mr. Milners, and I'm attempting to clarify that point. I'll divide my argument today into three parts and rely on the brief for the remainder of the points. First, the trial court abused its discretion when it signed a final decree of divorce that omitted two exhibits that were attached to and incorporated into the party's MSA. Secondly, the MSA itself was contingent upon certain actions that did not come to bear as negotiated. And thus, alternatively, it was an abuse of discretion for the trial court to uphold the MSA under those circumstances. Lastly, Your Honors, if this court decides to keep the MSA and the decree in place as written, then we ask this court to render judgment that the partnership interest that my client received as a result of the decree and MSA equates to a full partnership interest as it was negotiated and intended.
Well, excuse me. How does the trial court have jurisdiction over the partners to require them to accept her as a working partner, as opposed to simply an interest-owning partner?
The trial court has authority to enter judgment based on the mediated settlement agreement, which is a contract essentially between the parties. And as part of that MSA and as part of the final decree that was entered, it specifically is subject to the provisions of the partnership agreement. And when we look to the partnership agreement, specifically when we look to the section 8A that's on page 19, it specifically explains what is needed to be done to transfer partnership interest. And that includes a requirement of unanimous consent. So when the parties contracted and negotiated and bargained for this transfer of partnership interest subject to the partnership agreement, that's where it comes into play, that the other partners have to give their unanimous consent pursuant to the party's agreement.
What jurisdiction can't require that?
I agree that the other partners were not party to this suit, and the partnership wasn't sued as a part of this lawsuit. However, what the court can do is enforce the party's agreement and enforce the party's agreement as a contract. And when we look to the language of the mediated settlement.
How?
Because the court has a ministerial duty, the trial court has a ministerial duty to enter judgment based on a mediated settlement agreement that complies with Section 6602 of the Texas Family Code.
What's the vehicle for requiring the other partners to agree to the arbitration or the mediation agreement? There's no jurisdiction over them. They weren't part of the mediation. They didn't agree to the mediation. So how does the court get control over them?
I agree that the court doesn't have control over them individually. But I do believe that the court has control over the party's contractual agreement as found in the mediated settlement agreement, pursuant to 6602 of the Texas Family Code. And so the court does have jurisdiction to enforce that mediated settlement agreement. And a mediated settlement agreement is no more than a contract between the parties. And so when the parties drafted these agreements and drafted these documents that conform to what the partnership agreement allowed for and put those signature lines on there and said that it was going to be the required consent pursuant to the partnership agreement, the court does have jurisdiction to enforce that contract, essentially, to enforce that contract and make the parties live up to the bargain that they negotiated for and that they entered into. And when they put it into a mediated settlement agreement, it comes under the jurisdiction of the 6604, and the trial court has authority, in fact, has a ministerial duty to enter judgment based on that mediated settlement agreement. So I think that's where the power comes into play to enforce that mediated settlement agreement as it is. Your Honor, moving to my first issue, the decree that was entered was not consistent with the terms of the mediated settlement agreement. Even if you step aside from the issue that Your Honor just brought up in terms of the jurisdictional issue, Texas case law is very well settled that a trial court does not have authority to modify a settlement agreement to include any kind of terms or provisions. For example, the case of Kime versus Anderson, the El Paso Court of Appeals held that the trial court did not have authority to modify the settlement agreement. In that case, the trial court tried to include a prior court order regarding interim attorney's fees. Even though it was a prior valid court order, the appellate court reversed and remanded and told the trial court, you can't add terms to a party's agreement. You can't change the deal. And so what happened in this case is the mediated settlement agreement included an Exhibit A and an Exhibit B that was incorporated and attached. And that those exhibits were part of the party's deal. It was part of the brokered for and negotiated deal that occurred that day in mediation last July. Those two exhibits were entitled Required Consent with a capital R and a capital C. And as we'll soon learn, that's a term of art that's defined by the partnership agreement. Those two exhibits were entitled Required Consent, and they included signature lines for not just the parties, but also the other two partners, Joey Milner, Jack's brother, and Michael Hill. When the decree came before the trial court, the proposed decree offered by Jack, that decree no longer had Exhibits A or B attached to it. It didn't include any language, including required consent, or any language that would make it subject to that provision of the partnership agreement. Instead, Jack had offered a new Exhibit B, completely different from the two that were attached to the MSA, and all it said was an assignment of interest. So as you can see, at that point, Jack is already building the case for treating Vicki as a mere assignee under the partnership agreement and not a full partner. The trial court had a hearing on Jack's motion to enter the final agreed decree of divorce. And at that hearing, argument was presented that the decree in front of the trial court varied substantially from the mediated settlement agreement, and that under well-settled Texas law, including Kime versus Anderson, the trial court cannot change the deal. Despite initially seeming to rule that the parties should go back to arbitration pursuant to the mediated settlement agreement to sort out the differences, the trial court ultimately signed that final decree of divorce in August of last year. The entry of that decree, as it was drafted by Jack, completely neutralized the property award that was contemplated by the MSA. By omitting those two exhibits or omitting any language similar to that, the required consent phrase that was in those exhibit that means something pursuant to the partnership agreement was completely omitted, and that absolutely failed to make the MSA effective. It made it ineffective and made the property division ineffective. When we look to the partnership agreement, we see that required consent, the phrase, is defined, and it says it's the percentage of partnership interest that's required to admit new or substitute limited partners. And then when we look to Section 8A, where it talks about transferring partnership interest, it says it has to be unanimous consent of all the partners, parentheses, quotation marks, required consent. So it's a term of art, and it means something. And when those two exhibits were drafted on the day of mediation and attached and incorporated, and they used the phrase required consent multiple times, capital R, capital C, that's where you can see the intent of the parties. The intent was that we're going to comply with the partnership agreement when it talks about transferring partnership interests. So when the trial court entered a decree that completely omitted those terms, it gave Michael Hill the purported authority under the partnership agreement to treat Vicki as a mere assignee. No voting rights, no distribution rights, no power, no authority. In fact, the only thing she is allowed is to share in a tax liability of hundreds of thousands of dollars. If Michael Hill had signed Exhibit A and Exhibit B, as was intended by the mediated settlement agreement, he would no longer have that power to treat her as an assignee. When the parties brokered this deal on July of 2008, the clear intent and the clear belief was that Vicki was going to give up relatively the vast majority of the community estate in exchange for Jack's interest in the partnership. She was going to step into the shoes of Jack. When the trial court signed that decree, omitting those terms and omitting that language, it changed the deal. And so for that reason, the decree should be set aside, and the trial court did abuse its discretion in that regard.
Well, so under the mediated settlement agreement, though, Michael, this goes back to what Justice Stefano was asking a while ago. Michael was not a party to that mediated settlement agreement, and so his consent was never enforceable. And so doesn't the whole deal fall apart without Michael's consent, even without the court changing the deal?
You're right in that the deal does fall apart without Michael's consent. And that's one thing that's another alternative way to look at this issue before the court, is that mediated settlement agreement, as it was the day that the trial court entered judgment, it was an incomplete settlement agreement, because it contained these contingencies that, as your honors are pointing out, may not even be performable. It contains contingencies that, while they were agreed to by the parties at that time, were not performable, were inoperable, and were still outstanding at the time that the trial court entered that judgment that day. For example, there were at least three contingencies in the MSA that we can see. The first one, that the lender would replace Jack with Vicki as a guarantor. Well, that contingency was waived in open court. We don't need to worry about that one. The second contingency is that the entire deal, including the final decree of divorce, not just the MSA, subject to the provisions of the partnership agreement. Third contingency, subject to the execution of Exhibit A and Exhibit B by those that are listed on the signature lines. We know the day that the court looked at this proposed judgment that the signatures hadn't happened. To date, Michael Hill has never consented, never put his signature on that exhibit. But Joey Milner did a couple weeks after the mediation. At some point, Joey Milner did sign those exhibits, but Michael Hill never did. So we know that there were contingencies that weren't met. We know the contingency of subject to the provisions of the partnership agreement. Well, the partnership agreement says to transfer partnership interests, we need unanimous consent. And parentheses, that means the required consent. And we know we don't have that. So the trial court had before it an incomplete settlement agreement. And case law out there says that the trial court can't substantiate a final judgment on an incomplete settlement agreement because there's no meeting of the minds. For example, in Rogers versus Rogers, a decision that came out of Corpus Christi, husband had agreed to pay the wife a certain amount of money for 20 years in the final decree of divorce. But that settlement agreement said, oh, and we'll secure those payments however it's satisfactory for the wife's attorney. Trial court entered judgment based on those provisions. appellate court reversed and remanded and said there can be no meeting of the minds when you have a settlement agreement in front of you with outstanding contingencies, and final judgment can't be based on an incomplete settlement agreement. Thus, the appellate court reversed and remanded. In addition, the case of N. Ray Cashow that came out of the Houston Court of Appeals, it looked at Section 6602 of the Texas Family Code and held that while a party may have a right to judgment on a mediated settlement agreement, this doesn't deprive the court of discretion to review an agreement before entering judgment. And specifically in that case, there were several outstanding contingencies. Because of that, it was an incomplete settlement agreement. The trial court didn't have jurisdiction or didn't have authority under 6602 to enter judgment. One argument that I presume that Jack will be making today is in regards to general contract law. And one of the things that general contract law tells us is that the court presumes that the parties to a contract intend every clause to have some effect. So we have to assume that every clause in this mediated settlement agreement was intended to have effect. And so when we talk about the required consent and we talk about what it means to have the beneficial interest and record title, all those clauses need to be read in harmony to figure out what the party's intention was. One argument that I anticipate Jack will make is that the rights that were given to Vicki pursuant to the MSA were not full partnership rights. However, when we read the partnership agreement and we read those terms as they're defined in relation to the terms that are put in the MSA, it becomes clear that the intent was that Vicki would have full partnership rights, that being the term of required consent and what that means pursuant to the partnership agreement, as well as what it means to have beneficial interest and record title. Your Honors, the idea of divorce is an end result that's fair and equitable. And the lack of fairness and the inequity that happened with the trial court's ruling continues to affect my client every day and will continue to affect her in the future. To allow Jack to improperly attach this extreme nomenclature to the deal that was struck only really serves legal gamemanship.
Wait, what extreme nomenclature?
The extreme nomenclature I'm referring to, Your Honor, is his arguments regarding beneficial interest and record title. I see my time has expired. May I finish your question? He makes several arguments in his brief, several pages worth, trying to explain how beneficial interest and record title does not mean full partnership interest. Yet, when you look at that term in relation to the partnership agreement and in relation to the term of required consent, it becomes clear that that's exactly what the parties did intend that day. So he's trying to stretch the meaning of beneficial interest and record title. And if the court is to buy that argument, the court essentially has to look past the partnership agreement and look past several terms and provisions of the MSA. And so to allow Jack to do that really only serves legal gamemanship and doesn't serve Texas's public policy of peaceful, amicable resolution of disputes.
Are there any other questions?
No.
Any other questions?
For
Thank
these
you
reasons,
very much.
We ask the court to reverse and remand. Thank you.
Good morning, David Cook on behalf of Mr. Jack Milner. First of all, I would like to ask the court to disregard any of appellant's arguments that are arguments and documents that are outside the record. If the court reviews appellant's first brief as well as its reply brief, the court will find several instances where argument is made without any support of the record. I would ask the court to disregard any such argument without support. I believe the question here is whether or not the final decree comports with the mediated settlement agreement. And I would ask the court to, you know, simply pull out the mediated settlement agreement and look at page 4. It clearly states business interest. And if you look at that paragraph, it tells the court what the parties agreed to do. It says, Jack agrees to transfer to Vicki all of his beneficial interest and record title in and to the 44.055% community property interest in Thielen. And it says, subject to all liabilities thereon and all provisions of the existing partnership agreement. That's not a hidden document. That's a document that was provided in discovery. Both parties had a copy of it. And it's appellant's belief that the 44.055% community property interest is a majority interest. You will see that throughout appellant's arguments that that has somehow a majority controlling interest. But if the court looks at the partnership agreement and or simply the revised Limited Partnership Act, both the act and the agreement clearly states that in order to take any action, the partnership agreement requires majority in interest or unanimous consent. Obviously, unanimous consent would be all the interest, and obviously majority in interest would be more than 50%. At the time of the mediation, no partner owned more than 50%. That was the largest interest, 44.055%, but it was not a quote-unquote majority interest as argued by appellant. I believe it's critical to their analysis because it's their primary argument they used throughout the appellant's brief. Secondly, another common misstatement by appellant in the brief is that Joey Milner had sold his interest prior to the mediation. That's contrary to the record. I would ask the court to look at the affidavit of Joey Milner, which is attached at the trial court. It was actually part of the response to the motion for a new trial that was filed by Jack Milner. Thirdly, Ms. Milner makes the argument that her interest is worthless, and there's a footnote to that statement that the interest that she was awarded is quote-unquote worthless, and I would also point out to the court there's no such evidence in the record that it's worthless. I believe this court has asked questions with regard to that issue. I believe there is a dispute, but this dispute is different parties, and I think the term parties is being used loosely here. It's implied that parties include Jack Milner, Vicki Milner, the partnership, the LLC, Joey Milner, and Michael Hill. Simply the parties in this divorce case are solely Jack Milner and Vicki Milner. If there is a dispute between Ms. Milner and the partnership, she certainly has remedies, and I believe that she should elect those remedies and proceed with that. The record is clear that Ms. Milner testified that she had the opportunity to sit down with Michael Hill prior to mediation. There were offers to purchase by Michael Hill that were shared with both Vicki Milner and Jack Milner. There was no surprise. The only surprise was at mediation when she came in and asked for the business interest. That was a surprise, and that is in the record. It's also part of appellant's argument that Ms. Milner requested the business. This was not something that was suggested or proposed by Mr. Milner. Ms. Milner, in her affidavit, I believe it's in the reply brief, argues that that would allow her to have some type of income for a long period of time. And I believe this court has already made statements and asked questions with regard to that issue. Just because you're a partner or you have a beneficial interest in a partnership does not mean that you're entitled to a job, as an employee or truck benefits or things like this that Ms. Milner wants to argue. It's simply is a question of what do the parties agree and is that what the trial court awarded. And as far as the exhibits are concerned, if the court looks at the exhibits, the language is tracked exactly. If you look at the, I believe it's Exhibit A or Exhibit B, I think it's Exhibit B to the divorce decree, it's the assignment of interest, and it tracks the mediated settlement agreement word for word. And that's what Mr. Milner agreed to do. That's all Mr. Milner can agree to do is to convey what his interest is. He cannot bind the other Mr. Milner, Joey Milner, nor can he bind Mr. Hill, which he never agreed to do. In appellant's argument, counsel argued that there were three contingencies in the mediated settlement agreement. I would argue that there's one contingency, which was the first one she stated. It clearly states, and if you review the mediated settlement agreement, we specifically used the word contingent. It says the parties acknowledge that this agreement is contingent upon the existing lender or any successor lender accepting Vicki as a guarantor in place of Jack on all existing liabilities of the Thielen businesses. That was the only contingency in this MSA. And Mr. Milner did waive that contingency by testimony at the motion to enter because it was for his benefit. He waived. It had not been done. He had not been substituted by Ms. Milner on the debt, but he waived that contingency. The second contingency that counsel argued is that the partnership agreement was a contingency. I would argue that the partnership agreement is not a contingency, but it is correct to state that the transfer from Jack to Vicki is, quote unquote, subject to the partnership agreement. I don't believe that's a contingency. I believe it's a specific statement in the mediated settlement agreement that the interest would be subject to the partnership agreement. The last contingency argued by Ms. Milner is that the MSA required the signatures of Mike and Joey, and there are simply no requirement that they be required to sign because they were not parties. Either Mr. Milner or Ms. Milner could attempt to get them to sign, which we did, and Judge Berger at the trial court level did, I guess for the lack of a better term, order me to contact Mr. Hill to see if he would, in fact, sign the document. And I did contact him and his counsel, and there had been discussions between Ms. Milner's attorney and Mr. Hill's attorneys, but Mr. Hill's attorney simply told me that that they would not sign, that he would not be signing the consent. And so we prepared the divorce decree based upon the MSA, and we prepared the assignment of interest based upon the MSA, which is what I believe we are required to do. We do not believe that the MSA is incomplete. We believe that it has all the terms necessary to represent and complete the party's agreement. Ms. Milner did attempt to withdraw her consent from the MSA. The case law will show that in order to withdraw your consent from a 6.602 mediated settlement agreement, you must allege and prove fraud, coercion, or illegal act. Ms. Milner, in fact, testified that none of that occurred here. Counsel, I believe, in their brief, attempted to change Ms. Milner's testimony, but her testimony to Judge Berger at the trial court level was that there was no coercion, that this was a voluntary act on her part. And in the withdrawal of consent, which is attached to the appellate's brief, you will see that there is no allegation of fraud, coercion, or illegal act. It's simply an attempt by Ms. Milner to withdraw her consent from the MSA, which, pursuant to 6.602, you cannot do without fraud, coercion, or illegal act.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, ma'am.
Going back to your distinguishing between giving her a partnership interest versus giving her, transferring her the beneficial interest and title, but isn't Michael's consent also required to effectively give her an assignment of the business interest and title, beneficial interest and title? And isn't he trying to force her out because he didn't give his consent? And isn't he, doesn't that defeat the CSA?
No, Your Honor. If you will,
MSA.
I would draw the court's attention to page 374, which is where this is in appellate's brief. It's page 19 of the Agreement of Limited Partnership of Thielen Recycling Company LP. If you look at page 19. That is the general rule that deals with record title and beneficial interest. Next, I would point the court's attention to page 376 of appellant's brief, which is page 21 of the limited partnership agreement, paragraph 5. And there's a specific provision that deals with, I believe, Justice Gardner's question, and that's paragraph 5 is entitled Death, Divorce, or Declaration of Incompetency of a Partner. And so this provision, in my opinion, is the controlling provision and is the provision that would obligate Mr. Hill, I guess, to answer the court's question. This provision here is the party's agreement with regard to a situation where the partner's spouse receives all or a portion of such partner's partnership interest. It's specifically provided for. And this is the provision that the I believe the trial court relied on because it dealt specifically with divorce. Okay. I agree with the court. If Ms. Milner would have been a completely unrelated third party, then the court's statement that you just made would be entirely correct. But since she was a spouse of Mr. Milner, this provision deals with that situation. respectfully, on the behalf of the appellee, we would request the court to deny this appeal and assess the costs accordingly. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there a rebuttal?
May it please the court. I'd like to briefly clarify a few points that Mr. Cook made. When he talked about the paragraph in the MSA that talks about the transfer of the partnership interest, he's absolutely correct. It's entitled Business Interests. This is in the text of the MSA. This has nothing to do with Exhibits A and B. And yet now, Jack is trying to assert that business interest, that's what we called it in the MSA, does not mean partnership interest, even though the business is the partnership and the partnership is the business. This is another example of what I was referring to in terms of elevating form over substance with regard to this MSA. Furthermore, I'd just like to clarify that in our brief, when we talk about the majority interest holder and Jack being the majority interest holder, Mr. Cook is absolutely correct that in the partnership agreement, there is a definition of majority in interest in that terminology, and it does mean a partner with more than 50%. And he's absolutely correct that Jack didn't have more than 50%. And so I just wanted to clarify that I wasn't trying to assert that he had a majority in interest, rather that he just simply had the largest percentage ownership. The case being as it is now, at this point, Michael Hill has roughly 55% ownership interest in the partnership, and thus he actually is now the majority in interest. In addition, we did correct our brief in our reply brief by clarifying that it's correct that Joey Milner did sell his interests in Thielen to Michael Hill after the mediation and not before. Doesn't change the fact that Vicki had no knowledge of this. She did not consent to this. She had no information regarding this. And furthermore, that transaction took place with the approval of Jack, an indirect violation of the standing injunction in place still at that time. Your Honors, even if to address your concerns about the jurisdiction of the trial court over the non-parties to this suit, even with that being as it may, there are still two options before this panel to correct the wrong that's happened in this case. First, this court can simply render judgment that Vicki took full partnership interest in Thielen pursuant to the terms of the MSA and the terms of the decree as they relate to the partnership agreement. Even if the trial court doesn't have authority to make Michael Hill or Joey Milner consent to this agreement, the deal that was brokered still has terms in it that mean and were intended to mean Vicki takes full partnership interest. So this court still has the power to correct that wrong and find that the intent of the agreement and the intent in the decree is that Vicki takes full partnership interest as a limited partner, which is allowed by the partnership agreement in certain situations. So that's still an option before this court. The other option before this court is that this court can still remand, to reverse and remand the judgment, simply because the decree does not equal the MSA. The decree changed the terms of the MSA. Specifically, when the MSA used the terms required consent, and then the trial court took those terms out and replaced it with assignment, that changed the deal. And under well-settled Texas case law, trial court's not allowed to do that. So without getting into the territory of jurisdiction over the non-parties, that's still an option before this court to help right the wrong that happened in this case. By presenting the final decree that Jack did to the trial court, he's attempting to sidestep the obvious legal implications and legal ramifications that come with the terminology that's part of this MSA. And he shouldn't be allowed to do that in a court of equity as that the trial court is in. And very briefly, Your Honors, I just would like to clarify a point that that Mr. Cook made regarding the paragraph in the partnership agreement as to spouses. He's absolutely correct that it says that upon a divorce, if there's an ex-spouse who receives some kind of partnership interest, they're not going to come in as a limited partner unless it's provided for in the agreement or provided for in the Texas Revised Limited Partnership Act. And therefore, we're right back around to where we were in Section 8A, where it talks about transfer of partnership interest. So it is our position that that paragraph is rendered meaningless by that exception at the end of that paragraph, and we're right back around to Section 8A and the transfer of partnership interest that is allowed in certain circumstances in that case. We would ask that this court either render judgment, finding that Vicki is a full partner, a full limited partner in Thielen, or alternatively that this court reverse and remand and send these parties back to mediation to try to clarify the property division that they're in agreement with. Thank you.
Thank you. Excuse me. Your case is submitted. We appreciate your argument. We appreciate your being here on this rainy day. And you're free to go about your business if you would like. And we will recess briefly so the next case can announce.